Members, today is Monday, March 10th, and the time is 1, not 12, like your clock says. We are in daylight saving time, folks. So I call this meeting of Health, Finance, and Policy to order. First of all, Representative Gilman, have you had a chance to look at the minutes, and would you like to move their approval? And then you had a little announcement, too, I hear.
Yes, so moved. I moved the minutes. They look great. And I also said I'd bring treats for my bill last week. So I've got homemade Ghirardelli brownies or fruit. If you don't have gluten, you can have some fruit. So
okay.
I'll pass them around.
So Representative Gilman moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay. And we have another guest here, I see.
Cool. Oh, sorry.
Oh, a little antsy there, aren't you?
I was just making sure it worked.
Thank you for that test. This is a test of the chairmanship, I guess.
Yes. All right, members. First on our agenda today is House Files 696 from Chair Backer. I will move 696 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Backer, before we get started, you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move and adopt the A1?
I do, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Oh.
There you get.
All right. Chair Backer, introduce your bill, and let's, as amended.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, members. House File 696, one of the challenges that we have, especially in greater Minnesota, I think this won't be a surprise, is when it's a medical assistant run, and that person, A, refused care, B, is just a lip assist, or any number of other things in which we do not, as an ambulance service, transport, we do not get any payment from that for medical assistance. As Representative Hewitt would say, if the wheels don't turn, we don't get paid, and so forth. And roughly across the state, it's about 18 to 20% of the runs are a no-low situation. And it can also be a situation that, like a couple years ago in Donnelly, Minnesota, it was a full cardiac arrest. It was a delayed, it was a long scene time. Helicopter came in, landed, picked up the patient, and the Donnelly first responders got no payment on that because they did not transfer it. But the week later, they had a similar run, and because that person got transferred in the ambulance, what happened is then they got reimbursed. And as we know, smaller services like the one that I belong and other ones volunteer on gets anywhere from 100 to 120, maybe 200 runs a year. If that, we're running upside down. And all services across the state that provide any type of ambulance has no-load situations. Again, if they're refusal care, if it was just a lift assistant, sometimes, unfortunately, we do quite a few lift assistants to the local, to the point that we know how to get into the house. We know what the person wants for us to, where to put her, because I know one right on top of my head right now. I've been there many times. Her name is Debbie. Great person, but when the pager goes off, we know what we're doing. And generally, it takes about four of us to help her out. So with that said, I do have a testifier. I would like to turn it over to our testifier, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Fox, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is John Fox. I am the interim director at Dodge Center Ambulance in southern Minnesota. One of the things that I'm here to testify for is in support of this, along with any number of other things that you guys have been hearing, but this one in particular. While there's no silver bullet, this is one way we can help with that rural financial sustainability. Much like we were just talking about, any number of our responses are not paid for. And I just ran quick numbers because I was just, this was over the weekend, I just did a quick thing. About the last 90 days, I've had 68 responses in the last 98 days that are not billable. But I still had to staff, we still had to go out the door, we still had to go on out. And so right there, that falls well within that 15 to 25%, so 20% or so of our runs are not transports. And along that way, that's actually a good thing that we don't have to transport. We already have an ED over emergency department overcrowding. We are currently incentivized, either explicitly or tacitly, to transport if we want to get any funding. So if we do the right thing in not transporting, we actually take a penalty on that by not being paid, which even if it's the right thing to do. So if we have that ability, it removes some of that incentivization of transporting people unnecessarily. Most of my, I have about 14,000 hours of volunteer labor provided to me each year. So I want to make sure I get all the benefit back on out of that. We just had a cardiac arrest over the weekend that we're going to receive no money for, even though we spent, well, between labor, hundreds, probably close to $500 worth of medical supplies that we are not going to be able to bill for because we did not transport that because it was not viable and it just didn't work out that way. But we have those costs still incurred. So I want to maximize my revenue to reflect my volunteers' donation time. So this bill would help with some of that. The last little piece is basically just that 15,000 people in my service area receive the same level of service. That's on 800 billable patients, but that leaves 400 that we don't, and the donated labor of about 30 staff. We're doing great work, but we just need some help. That would be about the end of mine.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Is there anyone else from the public would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will close public testimony, and members, I will open it up for discussion and questions. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Backer, for bringing this. This is a really one of the things we on the task force that we kept reviewing and trying to figure out. For Chair Backer, in your own service, even if you got reimbursed on these no loads, what is that going to do for your service as your volume is not? I mean, is this going to let you hire more full-time people or not? You're all paid on call. So, what if we do this? What's it going to do other than give you some more money?
Representative Backer.
Yeah, and Chair and Representative Hewitt. Good question. A solution to what we're facing, as you're well aware of it, there's just not one magic bullet to that. So it would help us to get more dollars. You know, roughly we will do 120 to 130 runs a year. So 20% of that are there. So what it allows us to do is use those resources to help invest into the training. Because we pay for the training. If somebody, like right now, my nephew is going through the class. If he serves for 2 years, at least picks up 24 hours every month, you know, then he won't have to reimburse it. So we help with that. So it's not a big fix. As you are well aware of, we have to put more money into rural EMS. We did some good work last year together, us two, and also with the Senate. But it's a small step forward because it makes up such, if you think about it, 20% of the runs, even though we're a small service, it's pretty significant. And those monies will help us with training. We may be able to bump up instead of getting $2 an hour for call time. We may get 3 hours. Every little bit helps to keep the rigs rolling out the door. Representative Hewitt.
Representative Hewitt, follow up.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Backer, that's great. That's where I wanted to hear it going, is that it's, again, I think a lot of our rural services are doing the same thing you're doing, is that sure, you'd like to give more rewards to your members, but You're using it for very, very important things like training and the mandatory requirements we put on a lot of the, for a better word, volunteer staff. Mm-hmm. And I got to honestly say, I've never heard a pushback from our volunteer crews about more training. So that, I really thank you for that. To Mr. Fox, Mr. Chair, if I may, Mr. Fox, you mentioned that 60-80 of your calls was a month or a quarter that were non-transport.
Mr. Fox.
That was the last 90 days, so the last quarter.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fox.
Representative Hewitt.
So what's your total number of calls in that same quarter?
Mr. Fox.
We did 1,300 or so last year, so that's probably about 20%, give or take.
Okay.
Representative Hewitt.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fox, once again, this is just the non-loads that you are expected not to get paid on. You have a lot of, I would bet a certain percentage of that is also non-reimbursed runs that you get denied on, no insurance.
Oh.
So you, that's on top of this, am I correct?
Representative, Mr. Fox.
Yes, sir. That would be those flat out, absolutely, we don't even bother billing because we know we won't. That does not include some of those other ones that don't pay or are underpaying, or, for example, those that have a very high deductible plan that can't afford to pay us because they haven't met their deductible, so they choose not to pay us. Those kinds of, that's not included in there.
Final thoughts, Representative Hewitt.
Final.
we've got a lot of people on the list.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and I can end it here, but hearing that, that's kind of where I wanted to go, is that I think a lot of people, and I don't know if you're sanctioned by the city or if you're a full volunteer with a 501(c), either way, I think a lot of people take advantage of the system to think that this, they pay taxes on this, and they do not. It's very rare that a city is like St. Paul or like Hennepin County. Most of our rural cities do not. They might buy them an ambulance every 10, 20 years, but that's kind of where it is. So I don't want to take anybody else's time, but thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence.
Oh, thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Nadeau. And with your permission, I'll have two questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You can even have three.
I won't go crazy. Thank you, Chair Backer. My first question is, how much do would an organization get reimbursed for a trip that they didn't bill for? How do you decide how much that trip is worth?
Representative Backer.
Yes, good question. What we're, through the Office of EMS in the bill, we have a formula that, as you can see, it does focus on services that are the smaller. So if you, and with our amendment, we just had a technical error. So the amendment really doesn't change it outside of just making, put it in a better way with the formula. So if you look at 224, how the director must award points, and then at the end of the fiscal year, those points go are devised into the $3 million that's allocated. And as you can see, the larger numbers get less points. So if you look at line 3.1, for eligible EMS response 101 to 200, an eligible licensee is awarded for 1 point. But if you go down to 2.25, for those with 1 to 25, then they get 10 points for response. So it does give more money. I don't have, I think you might be looking at a specific amount. We did not run the numbers on the specific amount because it does vary. Every year is not the same with no loads. Here's what I know is right now we get nothing. A little bit of something is a better whole, a lot of nothing.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Representative Ryer?
Chair Nadeau. Thank you, Representative Backer, Chair Backer. I really don't understand the points. What does eligible EMS responses 1 to 25? Is that like the first one through the 25th one? I'm not really clear on how the whole point system works. And I'm not even challenging it, I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah, no.
Chair Backer.
Yeah, thank you. So For the first 25 no loads, they would get 10 points. Then from 26 to 50, that number, they would get 5 points. From 51 to 100, then they would get three points per response. So the smaller services, the less no loads you have. For example, practical, Browns Valley, we have roughly, let's just say, Nick's this year, we had 120 runs, and we had 20 runs that are no loads. So 20 times 10 would give you 200 points. So we would get 200 points, and then the EMS director would take all the points and then calculate what each point value would be. Let's say a point is, $10. I know I'm being very low, but that's simple math. So you would get 200 times 10, that's $2,000. That's how that would work. And I would assume it would be higher than that, but for simple math, that's how we do a point system. And I did work with the director of EMS last year. This actually came from another, I don't remember which state, but this came from another state.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take advantage of leniency on number three. Just to confirm that in subdivision 5, the eligible EMS responses, it has to be all 6 of the criteria or to be eligible?
Chair Backer.
Yes, yes, it would. Yes, yes. Yeah, good question. I just wanted to look at it before I'm letting my lips move. So, yes, that is correct. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chairs. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Backer. I think this is, I'm with you on kind of the direction you're going, and I appreciated hearing from Mr. Fox about the incentive to transport unnecessarily, which is not something I'd really thought about before, but I think that makes a lot of sense. The questions I have, though, are kind of about how this is working. And first of all, I mean, it's important you're excluding any services outside the metropolitan counties, which kind of makes me wonder, why that distinction. But also, so as I'm understanding what you're doing here, you have this pool of funding, and then you have you've come up with a way to distribute it that sort of meets the need as you're thinking about it, which. So I have a few questions here, I guess, and I'll just kind of tell you what they are and kind of my list, and I don't know if other people have some of the same kind of questions, but one is, how did you come up with the amount of money you're distributing, the $3 million? Why $3 million? Is that based on something or what? And then out of that, I didn't see any provision for administrative costs, so I don't know if the agency thinks they can do this for no cost so that all the $3 million would get distributed. That's kind of how the bill is written, that there wouldn't be any cost of administrating it. So that's kind of one question, how you got to that number and whether we would distribute the whole number. And then I just have sort of want to understand why you're doing 10, 5, 3, 1 for the point distribution here. Like after the 25th run, you only get half as many points for the very next run, which seems like a big jump. I just kind of want to understand your thinking a little bit about how you came up with that 10-5-3-1 distribution.
Sure.
You could talk about that a little. Thank you.
Well, let's take
Chair Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nadeau. In regards with $3 million, last year we tested a Sprint Medic program for about the similar amount. I thought if we're going to do a test, kind of follow a trend that we've done, okay? There, outside of that, there's no other reasons why the $3 million was picked, okay? And also, it's a smaller dollar amount, so if we're going to test something, I want something with some substance, but I don't want to go crazy in case it's a bad program, okay? So that's the first reason. I think your second question was why the point system?
Kind of how you came up with that, but also the administrative. I'm sorry.
Oh, administrative. Thank you. Thank you. I'm chair.
Chair Backer.
Yes. You are reading the bill correctly. $3 million. This does not look like it's a hard program to implement, so there is no additional administrative costs in this bill. It's pretty straightforward. That's the reasoning behind that, and of course, people are welcome to disagree with me, but that's the reasoning behind it. And the point system was, I really wanted to get to the towers, the smaller services, the Hennings out there, and really help with those no loads. Because the smaller number services, when you have a run that you have the volunteers, because we got to pay for readiness. We got to pay for readiness. That's why people dial 911, so we're ready. The whole logic behind that was to push the help down to services that have the least amount of runs there, and that's why we came up with those numbers. We didn't necessarily put our finger in the air, but we just looked at other runs and like, okay. And it's very skilled. I will admit this is very skilled to your volunteer services, folks.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. And then finally, Representative Backer, why did you exclude the metropolitan counties? Then if you're doing it by volume anyway, why exclude them?
Chair Backer.
Yeah, thank you. Most of the metro services are hospital-based, and they just have the volume that we don't have in greater Minnesota. So, again, the mindset behind this is the smaller volumes. So when folks go out to, like, for their cabins, and most of them, like, if you go to around in Otter Tail County, around Dent, Star Lake, that's a volunteer service. Mm-hmm. They get about 80 to 90 runs a year. So I know those folks because we do training together, like Representative Hewitt. We go up to Stanford in Fargo every year to do a full Sunday of training. I always meet those folks there. So just keeping those small services going and helping them as much as we can. That's why. Rural. Focusing on rural. That's my mindset there, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask Mr. Harney, there's a fiscal note on this bill. And so can you just go over the fiscal note for everyone in the committee?
Chair Nadeau, members of the committee, just quickly, there was a completed fiscal note on House File 696. It documented approximately $2,500 in administrative costs that can be absorbed by the office.
Thank you, Mr. Harney.
Yeah, thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, would Chair Backer, would you please close on your bill?
Yeah, folks, as we are well aware of, EMS in greater Minnesota, across the state, actually across the state, but especially in greater Minnesota, is still struggling. We did some good work last year. This is not a fix-all to all. It just solves a problem. It helps in one area where we respond to no loads or a lift assist or another ALS or another provider coming in like a helicopter or ALS to pick up that patient, to help just make sure it's another two in the toolbox when people dial 911 in greater Minnesota that rig is leaving the garage and we're there in a very timely manner to help your loved ones at some of their greatest challenges they face during their lives.
Thank you, Chair Backer and members. The chair lays over House File 696 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Members, next, we are joined by Jeremy Drucker, Director of the Office of Addiction and Recovery. We will let the director get through his presentation before turning to members' questions. Director Drucker, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Becker, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Drucker. I'm the director of the Office of Addiction and Recovery, and in this role, I chair a subcabinet that consists of 8 state agencies, including the Department of Human Services, Health, Corrections, Public Safety, Education, Higher Education, the Interagency Council on Homelessness, and Minnesota Management and Budget.
And I understand you have a presentation, so you feel free to pause to get that up, and if you need any help from House staff.
Plugged in, but there seems to be technical difficulties. Oh, there it is. We just had to unplug it and plug it back in. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, Chair Becker.
Proceed, yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. As I said, my name is Jeremy Drucker. I'm the director of the Office of Addiction and Recovery. I'm presenting today on the state's response to substance use and the opioid epidemic. Before I jump in real quick, though, I just want to say that no progress that we make in this area is done without the partnership of many different entities, including the legislature, our county and local governments, tribal governments, community partners, law enforcement, and many other folks. And so this is truly a team effort, and it really takes all of us working together to make the progress that we're trying to make in this area. This is also a very bipartisan area. This is an area where we have a lot of agreement, and I've had the great fortune of being able to work with really excellent members on both sides of the aisle on this, both as thought partners, as we think about what are the best steps that Minnesota can take to protect lives and keep our communities safe. So with that, I'm going to jump in. I'm going to move through these slides somewhat expeditiously so that there's time for questions at the end. But stepping back overall, when you look at substance use disorder in the state of Minnesota, alcohol use is still the number one substance that is misused. When you look at that slide up at the on the right hand side of the corner, the right hand side of the screen, you will see that admissions for alcohol are about 25,000 a year. Methamphetamines come second, injection drug use, heroin, and other opioids coming next. You'll see also that excessive drinking alone costs Minnesota about $8 billion a year through loss of productivity, healthcare, and other costs. And overall, in 2022, there was about 62,000 people were admitted to substance use disorder treatment programs. That doesn't represent the full need. The Department of Human Services has estimated that upwards of 300,000 Minnesotans could use substance use disorder treatment. Drilling down into opioid use, in 2023, about 9 million Americans, 12 or older, misused opioids in the last year. And when you look at overdose deaths, they really skyrocketed in 2019. The reason 2019 is such an important date on this is when you look at the opioid epidemic, it really moved from east to west. And 2019 was when fentanyl, what we call tipped the market in Minnesota, where it became the dominant opioid on the market. And because it's so strong, fentanyl is 50 times more powerful than heroin. We saw deaths really begin to skyrocket then. Over the last 2 years, though, we've seen actually overdose deaths begin to decline. So in 2023 and 2024, the 2024 numbers are not final yet, but in 2023, overdose deaths dropped by about 8%, and then we're looking at even more significant reductions in 2024. When you look at some of the substance use disorder population impacts, there are certain groups that are impacted more than others when it comes to overdose deaths. So justice-involved individuals, so those who are encountering law enforcement on the front end, currently incarcerated, exiting incarceration, or have a justice-involved background, have a much higher rate of overdose than other Minnesotans. About one out of five overdoses since 2019 was from an individual who was released from a correctional facility within the last year. Also, people experiencing homelessness also experience overdose deaths at much higher rates. A study from the Department of Human Services and Hennepin Health in 2023 found that one in three deaths from people experiencing homelessness was caused by a substance use overdose, primarily fentanyl. When we look at opioid overdose deaths by race, we find many of the same disparities that we find in other areas like education and employment. American Indian Minnesotans are far more likely to overdose than white Minnesotans. Black Minnesotans also far more likely to overdose than white Minnesotans. I think one thing, though, to point out in this slide, though, which I think is a very encouraging trend, is when you look at the 2024 numbers, we're seeing deaths go down across race and ethnicities, which means that the reductions we're seeing is not just in one population group, but we're really seeing reductions across all of those populations groups, which is encouraging to see. When you look at overdose deaths by region, you'll see that, again, across every region of the state except for South Central Minnesota, where there were a small number of opioid overdoses to begin with, we're seeing big reductions from 2022 to 2024. Again, this is encouraging news. I would want to just preface that by saying we don't want to take our eye off the ball. It is good and certainly encouraging that there are fewer overdose deaths, but non-fatal overdoses are not declining at the same rate. So what that leads us to believe is that the opioid epidemic is still a significant problem when it comes to impacting our communities, impacting families, communities, public safety, and all of those other things. We are just gotten much more adept at minimizing the worst case outcome of an overdose in the opioid epidemic, which is a death. Some of the key takeaways that we see from the opioid epidemic, in 2023, 70% of overdose deaths in Minnesota involved at least one opioid. Commonly prescribed opioids are no longer the major cause of opioid overdose deaths. Fentanyl is involved in over 90% of those opioid overdose deaths. So again, when we think of the trajectory of the opioid epidemic, began with prescription drug abuse and sort of the excesses of the pharmaceutical industry, leading in transforming into heroin and then turning into fentanyl. I think now we're looking at a fourth sort of transformation right now, where many of much of the illicit drug use is polysubstance. So it's fentanyl mixed with methamphetamine, mixed with cocaine, mixed with xylazine, mixed with things that I can't pronounce. And it all kind of comes into a really sort of toxic blend that is out there on the street. So it's quite deadly and it's very concerning. I would also say that two of the interventions that we found over the last 8 years of dealing with this crisis that have been particularly effective are medications for opioid use disorder. So these are FDA-approved drugs that are proven to reduce substance use for opioids. They're most effective when used in combination with counseling and behavioral health therapies. So when we say MOUD or medications for opioid use disorder, we're really thinking of three main categories of drugs. So methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. There's many different varieties of those categories, but those are the main ones. The other thing that we found is a really effective strategy is harm reduction, which is really recognized as a way to limit harms to communities and help keep people alive long enough to find a pathway to recovery. And when we think of harm reduction, we think of a spectrum of services, including naloxone distribution, including street outreach, helping people get access to services, wound care, and taking care of people's individual needs. Before we get into some of the very specific things that and activities that the state is doing, this is really a whole of government effort. The next two slides just really describe the different state agency roles in addressing substance use and misuse. The Department of Human Services is, obviously the largest funder of prevention, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery services in the state of Minnesota as the Medicaid agency in the single state authority. They draw down significant federal funds in order to address this crisis. They also support the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council in administering the state's share of the opioid settlement funds. So again, 25% goes to the state, 75% goes to local governments. And then separately, they also manage the federal state opioid response grants, the SOAR grants, SAMHSA substance abuse block grants, and a whole host of other state and federal grants that are available. They're also a key data partner when it comes to treatment admissions. Direct care and treatment, so as we think about the future of the Department of Human Services, direct care and treatment will be spinning off. Direct care and treatment is a very important entity when it comes to addressing substance use and opioid use disorder. They are really the SUD provider of last resort. Individuals often get civilly committed for substance use disorder. Those are housed often in the care facilities, community addiction resource enterprise. But also many of the state agency, but there are other clients, both in MSOP and Security Council or Security Hospital, many of them experience SUD as well. The Department of Health is also a major player. They are the state public health authority, and they administer many grants across the substance use continuum. I'm not going to go through each and every one of the state agencies, but you have them in your packet, and so if we're always happy to take follow-ups or do meetings to describe more of the state agency's roles in this. I would just point out, though, one other one, which is the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections is one of the largest, if not the largest, treatment provider in the state of Minnesota. They have over 1,000 inpatient beds, and many, they estimate about 85% of their population have a substance use disorder. So, the way that we approach substance use disorder in the state of Minnesota, and sorry, I jumped ahead here, but we really look at the full continuum of care. And so what we mean by that is the spectrum of services and supports to address both getting ahead of substance use and misuse on the front end, all the way through treating substance misuse and substance use, and then helping people maintain recovery. So we often think of the substance use disorder continuum of care as prevention, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery. Though in reality, it's not quite as neat and linear of a line as that. It loops back on itself many times. Recovery is not always a linear journey. And oftentimes recovery and prevention kind of blend together. But it's easy to think, it's much more manageable to think about it as a linear continuum. We do have four major categories of SUD financing in the state of Minnesota. So Medicaid is the primary payer. Medicaid pays for treatment for all low-income Minnesotans. By far, the largest expenditures in the SUD space is for treatment for individuals. DHS also manages the Behavioral Health Fund. Behavioral Health Fund covers individuals who are eligible for but not enrolled in Medicaid. It also pays for some ancillary services in the SUD treatment space as well. We have a whole host of different state and federal grants. These are sometimes one time. These are sometimes ongoing. But these are a broad category that includes many different pieces in the prevention, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery space. I would add that grants are the primary funding mechanism for prevention and recovery and harm reduction. And then finally, opioid settlement funds. Again, 75% go to counties and cities over 30,000. 25% of settlement dollars go to the state. One thing I would just want to point out, though, is in the slide to the right, is looking at the funding sources for treatment admissions. You'll note that public programs pay for about 75% of treatment admissions. So as we're thinking about payer mixes and we're thinking about provider rates and we're thinking about all of those different pieces, I think recognizing the amount that the state contributes and pays for in that space is just something to keep in mind. So examples of some state efforts across the continuum. So prevention, even within sort of the continuum of care, prevention, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery, there are multiple different activities that take place within those buckets. So when we think of prevention can be sort of primordial prevention, which is social determinants of health. Things like anti-poverty measures, like the Children's Tax Credit, can be considered prevention in that space. Also things like community-based prevention support, culturally specific outreach, disrupting pathways to adolescent substance misuse, public awareness campaigns to reduce stigma and promote treatment and well-being. All of those things kind of fall into the prevention bucket. When it comes to harm reduction, we think about naloxone funding and distribution. We think about outreach programs. The Department of Health has some harm reduction health and housing hubs that really looks like the intersection of homelessness and substance use. And then there's also, we have drug checking programs. This is a new program that was authorized in the 2023 legislative session. But going back to what we said previously about just how toxic and how unknown many of the substances are out there, drug checking allows for small quantities, trace amounts of substances to be tested, be sent to the Department of Health's Mendoza lab, which then can give us a sense of what is the drug composition on the street that allows our law enforcement and public health partners to be more effective in response. Treatment is exactly what you probably think it is. It's residential, inpatient, outpatient. It's medications for opioid use disorder, all of those different pieces, primarily Medicaid funded, and then recovery, looking at peer support specialists, recovery community organizations, recovery friendly workplace initiatives, which I'll say more about at the end, but really looking at how do we help people achieve sustained momentum in their recovery, building recovery capital, things like housing, education, a job. All of those things provide momentum in a recovery that helps people from sliding back into use. This slide, again, just for your background, if you want to take a look at it later, really looks at another way to think about the SUD response across the lifespan and of social and ecological systems. So thinking about both how does our response address the individual, the interpersonal, the community, and the societal. Recovery is a very person-centered, personal thing, but we all exist within within communities, within a world, within social relationships. And so as we think about how we address substance use disorder, we're always thinking about the different ways in which an individual and their use or recovery can be moved in a positive trajectory across these different systems. And then finally, I just want to cover a few key state initiatives that we're working on that I think bear thinking. So one is the Department of Human Services has an 1115 SUD reform waiver. This is really the initiative that sets up our treatment, prevention, and recovery system. All of our providers, I believe I can have my colleagues at DHS verify this, but almost all providers are now enrolled in that SUD reform waiver. DHS is doing many trainings throughout the year, helping providers kind of meet those standards. Really, those are focused on helping our providers meet the American Society of Addiction Medicine standards, which are sort of the gold standard when it comes to treatment, and making sure that all those providers are caught up there. Those ASAM standards are being slowly incorporated into state law, and I believe fourth edition just came out, and so there may be some updates on that. Also, I just want to flag the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections 1115 reentry waiver. We talked about sort of justice-involved individuals and sort of the role that substance use plays in their lives and their and ancillarily to communities. The 1115 reentry waiver would allow us to use Medicaid dollars to pay for behavioral health services for incarcerated Minnesotans, both in prisons and jails. This is a years-long systems reform effort that when it is finished and finally implemented statewide will fundamentally transform the way that we care for carceral individuals. That will have tremendous impacts both on public health and public safety. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association and our county partners and many other entities are firm allies in that effort, and we are really grateful for their partnership there. Additionally, the Department of Corrections is in the midst of rewriting their jail rules. So these are the fundamental standards that set basic levels of service in our jails. And substance use disorder and services are part of that. The Department of Health got funding for a comprehensive overdose morbidity and prevention act, which is a full spectrum of seven strategies to address the opioid epidemic, which is now fully implemented and doing a lot of good work out there. MDH is also implementing cannabis SUD prevention grants. So in the adult use cannabis bill, there was significant funding for prevention activities, both for our local governments, tribes, and also community-based organizations. And those dollars are beginning to go out as well. The Department of Education is implementing statewide health standards right now with a they're in the middle of their rulemaking process. There's a strong substance use component there. So what are age appropriate times for kids in schools to start learning about substance use prevention activities? Finally, the recovery friendly workplace initiative. So one of the things we're trying to do is create more recovery in more places. One of the places to do that is in the workplace. This is not just for individuals with substance use, but their parents, family members, other folks, other employees who may have a family member experiencing substance use disorder. And so we're in the midst of implementing that as well. The governor signed an executive order in October ordering the state of Minnesota as an employer to become a recovery friendly workplace to really lead the way in that effort. And then finally, naloxone saturation. This is just an effort that we're working with across our partner agencies, harm reduction partners, law enforcement, counties, to really ensure that we're getting naloxone into the hands of every community that needs it in the format and quantity that they need. And with that, I'm done. And so I will stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Behrman, you're first on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, Commissioner, which do you prefer? Seems redundant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, anything you want to call me is fine.
I like Commissioner today, so I'll say Commissioner Drucker. Thank you. On the last page, the naloxone saturation you mentioned, how close are we to saturation in the state of Minnesota? You know, I've talked and heard that sometimes the portal, there's nothing there, and I just wanted to hear your comments on that.
Director Drucker.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Representative Bierman. So that is a great question. That is one of the reasons why we started this initiative, was because we didn't know if we had achieved saturation or not. And so part of this process was to do a landscape analysis of the naloxone distribution system here in Minnesota. My colleagues at Minnesota Management and Budget conducted that analysis. One of the things that we found out, I believe the bill after this will somewhat address, is that we don't have a clear picture of naloxone saturation here in the state, that we have some key data elements missing. And so we are looking to address some of those data issues. And so in the saturation strategy, there's four pillars: data and integration, education and training, partnerships, and funding and procurement. And so as we are moving in this process, coming up with a metric and ways to define saturation and ensuring that we have the data sources to give us the data we need is a top priority.
Thank you.
And just one second, Representative Bierman, we're going to go to probably about five after, so it gives us 20 minutes for questions, 20 no later than 10 after, because we've got two other bills here. So just keep that in mind. Right now we have six members on the list, and back to you.
Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
Chair Backer, thank you. Commissioner, also on that same page, you mentioned the 1115 reentry waiver, and I don't think it's live yet, but I wonder if you have an idea of when it will be. I presume this year?
Chair Backer, Representative Bierman, the application for the waiver has been submitted to the federal government. This kicks off a back and forth process between the state and the federal government as we sort of negotiate the terms of that waiver. So I can't say when that will be live right now, but there are some other component pieces that go into this waiver as well.
Representative Bierman, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Thank you, Commissioner, for the update on that. And before I go any further, I just want to thank you for the work you're doing. This is really complex, and it affects so many levels of government and society, and, you know, we're all experiencing this in some way, shape, or form with people we know. I just heard another friend of mine who's, you know, had a nephew that passed away last night because of this. And so it's really something that's, you know, when it's not top of mind, it quickly becomes top of mind again. On your page on the example of state efforts across the continuum, one thing, that prevention piece, you know, you have a lot of really good things here. Community-based prevention support, pathways to disrupting adolescent substance misuse. I mean, that to me is clearly education, and in this committee we had a bill on this, educating youth about the dangers of opioids. And what came up was a longer conversation in how we are doing as a state with the funding coming in between all the levels of government that are getting funding, whether it's county, state, cities. I just wanted to hear you comment on the interaction and the level of collaboration and integration at this point. I know it, you know, just started relatively recently, but how are we doing as a state in collaborating with all the entities so we're not overlapping and doing the same things as others in this space?
Director Drucker.
Thank you, Chair Backer and Representative Bierman. Coordination is both a noun and a verb. It takes a lot of effort to get it going, and it falls apart very quickly if it doesn't have constant attention to it. I think we're doing a much better job than we were previously in collaboration. I think there's always more to do. We have many conversations, especially with our county partners and community-based providers, around looking at some of what they're doing. We have the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council dashboard, which helps track the state and local and county spending through the opioid settlement funds. I think as you probably saw, and if you take some time to review the two slides with the state agency roles, you'll see that there are about a dozen state agencies with a role in addressing substance use. And so one of the things my office is working on now is what we call a fiscal map, which is really mapping and tracking the sources and uses of funds across the administration. And I think we'd be delighted to share those findings with this committee when that's finished.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Backer. Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Backer. And I'll go really quick. I think it's great this working with the DOC. As some of you know, that Dakota County this morning just cut ribbon on their jail that is more of a healing space for people with addiction, more of a healing space for people with mental health issues. And this really will help them sustain that with getting help for the meds and the health care they have. So I look exciting. Sometimes we start these programs and we have to kill them because we don't have the money there for it. So this is really, I'm excited to see how that grows and how it helps our county, or actually I guess it's going to be a regional center. So thank you.
Okay, next on the list is Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Backer, and thank you, Commissioner. My first question I have is on page 11. When we talk about the opioid settlement funds, of the counties, 75% goes to counties and cities over 30,000. How many counties and cities that are impacted by opioid deaths are not covered in those settlement funds? Do you have those?
Director Drucker.
Yeah, thank you. I believe every county gets a portion of the settlement funds. Only cities over 30,000, so I don't have that number off the top of my head, but it's probably fewer than the number of cities that exist in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. So just to follow up on that, just in greater Minnesota, and I just look at the folks that are impacted in these communities, I'd be so curious if they don't qualify and they're not getting those services, and that kind of takes me to the harm reduction piece of it. Do you know how many FTEs there are that are doing harm reduction? Not only like, you know, in the metro, but greater Minnesota that are doing the harm reduction piece. I heard you say street outreach, individual needs. Like, so I'm guessing there are folks that do a lot of wraparound services, but I'm wondering how many FTEs are working in that, and how many are you still looking for in that area that are not filled yet? There we go. Thanks.
Okay. Director Drucker.
Thank you, Representative Backer and Representative Gilmore. The syringe or the harm reduction outreach, and many of that is provided by or is done by our community-based providers. So these are private NGOs, nonprofit organizations. So I don't have a head count there. I do know that it is very intensive work, and so we're always looking for individuals who have that passion to serve in that area. But I do not have a head count or a sense of exactly what the workforce need is there.
Any Representative Gilman.
So here's my follow-up to that. I'm just very interested in, I just want to put this on the record, in just finding out how we can support our communities, because when I see the disproportionate amount of folks that are in our Native community and our Black community, as well as those in greater Minnesota. I am really concerned that we just take a lot of time and effort and support these communities that are so impacted. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mahmoud.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I just wanted to understand a little bit, as we talk about fentanyl moving from East Coast to the West Coast, those trends, what sort of street drugs are we seeing currently?
Director Drucker.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Representative Muhammad. Right now, it runs the gamut. I think the ones that most, what is most alarming, though, is that we don't really know what is in the substances that are on the street at any given moment. Or let me rephrase that. People buying substances don't know what is in the substance they are purchasing. And so, you know, one of the really powerful moments of this job is meeting with the parents of children who have died or overdosed, thinking they were taking one substance and it really had fentanyl in it. And so that was part of the impetus around some of the drug checking programs that we've begun implementing, is to really get a better sense of what are those drugs. I think what is in the substances, and it changes depending on who the supplier is. The fundamental components are relatively stable in the sense that it's cocaine, in terms of illicit drug use, it's cocaine, methamphetamine, synthetic opioids like fentanyl and carfentanil. There's also additional sort of adulterants that go into them now, like xylazine, which is a horse tranquilizer, which both extends but also moderates a little bit the high of fentanyl. Fentanyl is 50 times more powerful than heroin, but it doesn't last as long. Xylazine extends that high. And there's other pharmaceuticals that are now being blended in. And so it's really a hodgepodge.
Representative Mahou.
Yes, thank you. And then, so I'm guessing we're probably going to see this new street drug in the Twin City area first, before it goes out into greater Minnesota. Do we see that? Is that a trend?
Okay. Yeah, Director Drucker.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Representative Mahomes. Oftentimes, drugs will come up from the southern border and kind of up the 35 corridor, but not always. One of the things that is what's so valuable about this drug checking program is that if we do have a new substance that comes on the street, it can go right to the Department of Health lab and we can begin analyzing it. And if there is something in there that is significantly more dangerous, the Department of Health can put out a health alert, and alert local public health and kind of get the word out. Can also use word of mouth to get out to communities of those harm reduction workers who are out there interacting with people who use drugs and help get them the information they need to stay safe.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you. No, that's all.
Okay, thank you. We have Representative Carroll. You're on deck.
Thank you, Chair. You know what? In the interest of time, I'll take my questions offline and go directly.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative. We now go to Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair Backer. And thank you for being here. Thank you for doing this. The work that you guys do and all the partners involved in this is profound and hard. Maybe it's just me. I'm frustrated with the array and the number of partners, the lack of coordinating that happens between tribes and counties, and the number of, and this is primarily in the harm reduction thing, which is the most difficult to measure as far as which interventions are actually moving people forward. It's important work in a lot of really difficult areas, but I have two questions. One of them was, can you spend some time talking about how you plan to, or what you think we should do as far as honing in in harm reduction, and what are those interventions that we should be looking at measuring, and what is our goal? I mean, if our goal is just to eliminate deaths, we're moving in that regard, and that's great. We're putting a lot of naloxone into the field. We're training people how to do it. We're saving people's lives. But what I didn't see in here is, where's the graph of people entering recovery? Where is that? Where's that part? Where are we being successful? And I think there's every person in this room is you know, we are on board to try to solve this crisis, but we continue to have more and more partners. And you said to yourself, there's 12 state agencies, there's 87 counties, there's 11 tribes. I mean, we have a very haphazard, in my opinion, approach to this, and I'm really looking for some leadership on how do we hone in on what works. So can you spend a little bit of time talking about harm reduction? How do we get in front of this issue, and how do we, and what do we want to measure as success?
Director Drucker, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Representative. Couldn't agree with you more. I think, when we look at, I think the patient was in crisis, was brought into the emergency room, we need to stabilize the patient, but now how do we get the patient on a healing journey? I think looking at what are some of the metrics that we would want to look at, I think looking at referrals to treatment, I think looking at treatment placement, I think looking at the number of prescriptions for medications for opioid use disorder, which are the gold standard. You know, when we, Centers for Disease Control has been studying harm reduction for over 30 years now and found that those who engage in harm reduction services are five times more likely to enter treatment. I think working with our state agency and county partners to really think about how we can begin measuring those referrals to treatment would be very valuable. I think, again, looking at, again, who's being connected to services, who's continuing to show up with services. We know people sometimes fall off. And so I think all of those combined can be really valuable indicators. And then I think looking at treatment admissions overall, the DANE system has important data within it. That's the DHS. The whole acronym eludes me, but it's the system that tracks treatment admissions and payment methodologies in those pieces. So using that to give us that sense of, how many people are completing treatment. I think about 48% complete treatment now, but we can get you that number. So I think those are some of the metrics that I would look at to ensure that, as you say, we are moving people into recovery pathways.
Representative Dole.
And thank you. And, we're speaking the same thing. And my question is more pointed, is that what can your agency do to ensure that we're collecting that data? Is that part of the plan? Is that something that you plan on doing? That's my question.
Oh,
and hope.
Director Drucker.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Backer, and thank you, Representative. Apologies for misreading the question. We just actually had a meeting last week about how we can start establishing some statewide metrics and objectives outside, Each individual agency has a lot of really good plans and a lot of good strategies, so the DOC, DHS, MDH, but really we're working on creating a statewide interagency strategy that really addresses some of those questions. The fiscal map exercise that I mentioned is part of that, really looking at what are the funding mechanisms and the tools across the administration that we have to use, but also looking at what are the goals and objectives and metrics so that we can align those across agencies. That's one of the things that my office is going to be working on over the next year.
Follow-up, Representative Dole.
Excellent, and thank you. And I look forward to seeing, the results of that. I was very excited to see that you were doing a fiscal map. So thank you very much.
Okay, our final set of questions for the director will be from Representative Franson. You're on deck, or you are not on deck, you're there.
Wow, look at saving the best for last, right, members? Okay, so I have a question. As I'm looking at the substance use disorder from MMB here, it says that Minnesota opioid involved overdose deaths increased 51% from 20 to 2022, and the number of deaths have more than doubled since 2019. Although there has been a 3% decrease in deaths in 2023. My question to you is, we are spending a lot of money on naloxone. We spend money on needle exchange programs, the taxpayers, those hardworking taxpayers that are funding these programs. And how do you track whether or not these programs are actually working, or if it's just contributing to the increase of the opioid crisis that we are facing in this state, if that question makes sense to you?
Director Drucker.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Representative. So there is the large-scale data that we know from the CDC of evaluation that shows that individuals who encounter and work with harm reduction partners enter treatment at five times more than those who don't. you know, I think it's difficult to sort of answer that specifically in terms of, because many of our community-based providers don't report that data for whatever reason. Also in terms of naloxone, we don't always know when an overdose is reversed. And so we do have, what we do have though is the overall overdose deaths. And that's one of the, that's one of the methods that we're looking at in terms of tracking whether what we're doing is working. But I think to your point too, similar to what Representative Nadeau was saying was, how do we make sure that we're not just sort of stabilizing the patient and keeping them alive right now, but how are we ensuring that they are being moved and are really leading a purpose-filled life and getting into that recovery pathway?
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think that we should be tracking that and doing a better job of that. So if we know that this is actually working, or if perhaps we need to tweak the program if it's encouraging those to continue addiction behaviors because there is, I guess, a so-called safety net using naloxone. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, members. Good questions. And thank you, Director Drucker. We appreciate you coming in. And next on, we're going to do a little different change here. We're going to take House File 1376 from Representative Baker, not Backer, but Baker. So the chair moves House File 1376 be referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. Representative Baker, before we get started, we are going. So we are passing out the amendment. There was it got posted but didn't get printed.
Thank you.
You got
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonner.
Just to be fair, I think you said you were having House File 1376 before.
Yeah, yeah,
1379. Just to make sure we follow you.
Yes, you're right, Representative Bonner. Slip of the tongue, we are on House File 1379. Thank you. And right now, members, the author's amendment is being passed it out. It did get posted, but didn't get printed. So we're just going, we're going to let that get out to folks. And then we'll turn over to Representative Baker here in a minute or two. Okay, the amendment's out there just because of making sure we're on the same page. We'll rewind this a little bit. The chair does move House File 1379 be referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. Representative Baker, before we get started, we're going to adopt the author's amendment. So the chair moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Baker, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I was just going to give a quick overview of what the amendment does. It just makes sure it clarifies a couple of exemptions for surgery complications if somebody is given an opioid when they've actually not had the when the surgeon or something didn't see the directive. So I just want to say thank you for that. It is how we want to do it, and that came to us as a request from the Minnesota Medical Association. So we want to make sure it works for everybody. But members, again, House File 1379 is an important bill to me. It's about authorizing and telling your provider, I don't want to have an opioid. It's a directive. And it's just something that goes in as a communication tool into the electronic health records. It's a simple one-page form. Other states are using it. And what it does tell the provider or the EMT, whoever has access to their records, if you're looking at somebody, there's an accident, there's something happening, oops, okay, this patient has requested not to have any opioids, if we can at all avoid this. There's other things they can take instead of an opioid. And my son was a perfect example of this. So I think that what I want to do is the bill establishes a non-opioid directive form. Again, it's simple, easy to fill in. The Department of Health would create the form and make it available to the public online. The form can be revoked at any time. And providers are not liable if they cannot feasibly access the patient's record. If there's an emergency situation or a provider determines in their very best professional judgment that an opioid is medically necessary. The Minnesota Medical Association and the Department of Health have been consulted with this, and they have no issues with this language. A non-opioid directive is a tool to help patients advocate for themselves and can help facilitate this conversation between a patient and their provider by creating a concrete way to begin discussing what can sometimes be a very difficult topic to talk about that carries stigma with your provider. A directive can help create a treatment plan using alternative pain management situations and ensures that a personal, medical, and family reasons for avoiding opioids are respected throughout a patient's care journey. The directive promotes transparency and communication, supporting a safer and more personalized approach to treatment, and has been successfully implemented in 10 other states. I think, members, this is just one small step to have a little tool in the toolbox to make sure that people that are in a journey of sobriety and have fought through this horrible world of trying to get away from these powerful synthetic drugs, this synthetic heroin that is important in medicine, but if it's given out too freely sometimes with a person who has really been struggling, this could be an enormous trigger if we don't at least do everything we can to let the doctor know. So again, members, that is the bill. I'll have a couple things to say at the end, and I have a testifier here alongside of me too, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Baker. Just to give members an kind of how we're planning to go with this bill to roughly 2:30, so we can take up the have 15 minutes for the last bill. And with that said, Ms. House, please state your name, and would ask you to keep your testimony down to 3 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Alicia House. I am the executive director of the Steve Rumler Hope Network. It's a nonprofit, for those of you who may not be familiar. It's a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to combating overdose fatalities in Minnesota. For nearly 5 years, I focused on mission through resource distribution, education, awareness, and advocacy. With years of experience in the field, I've witnessed the devastating effects of opioids on individuals and their families, and I've seen the cycle of suffering and the toll it takes on our communities. This bill is a much-needed step towards empowering patients to make informed decisions about their own care, especially those at risk. And I echo a lot of what Representative Baker had already said, but far too often individuals are being administered opioids for procedures without full knowledge. This is a violation of trust and personal autonomy, and it highlights the need for better safeguards. A patient's right to know what medications are being administered is fundamental to their care. And prior to my current role, I worked for a private provider that supported individuals with severe opioid use disorder in high-intensity residential, outpatient, and sober living settings. I saw clients sent out for dental work, only to return with an opioid prescription in hand. Prescriptions are often given without an understanding of the patient's history or their desire to avoid substances. This can lead to further complications in their recovery, undermining their efforts to break free of their disease. This bill will allow patients the ability to create a non-opioid directive, ensuring that they are not prescriber-administered opioids without their express consent. This empowers individuals, especially those in recovery, to take control of their treatment and avoid being unintentionally exposed to substances that could lead to a return of use or overdose. I strongly urge the committee to support the passage. It offers patients more autonomy over their health care and reinforces our commitment to combating the opioid epidemic with compassion and care. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. House. Would anyone from the public like to testify? Okay, seeing none. Representative Elkins, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a short question about how this works, Representative. As I understand it, it would be, you would execute this form and it would be uploaded and stored in your electronic health record in much the same fashion as an advanced care directive. And then there would probably be a little flag that would alert a provider to look for it. And then it would be available to anyone who has access to that health record.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, that's right. It's just, it's another tool to have a little tag that says there's a directive here. So, yes, correct.
Yeah, no, this is makes sense, and it should be easy to execute.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Elkins. We have Representative Carroll. You are next.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing this, and I appreciate your journey on this issue.
Thank you.
And I feel for you. So my question is regarding the necessity for this. So if you go into your provider and you say, I don't want opioids, shouldn't that be enough?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, it should be, but it's not. And I will tell you a quick example. My wife and I were in the exam room with my son, Dan, trying to get him some relief and planning on the surgery that was coming to try to help his back pain. And so we happened to get a provider we didn't know. It was out of town or we were in some other location. He was a specialist. He was super cocky, didn't listen to us when we actually asked him with Dan present. Dan is really struggling with opioids. We are trying to get him through this part. Is there any way that we can try to make sure that we minimize or eliminate maybe the use of this at this time? And he looked at us with this horrible grin, and we'll never forget it. It was just this feeling of, you don't know what you're talking about. And again, this was 15 years ago. Yesterday, Dan died 14 years ago yesterday. And so I know it was a year before he passed away. So I clearly remember that. Now, had we, Dan, he was an adult, so he could have put the mandate on his form, and I wouldn't have to have that. It would have been there for him to say. I didn't have to have the look of this. I know better than you do, Mr. Baker. Thank you very much. So we left there feeling very unsure of what we could do. We're not trying to overstep our bounds. I am not a doctor. We're not trying to get any doctor in trouble. 15 years ago, I think, they were doing things differently, and today it's different. So this is, I think, just when I saw this bill come up and some discussions that we've had in the past, this is an important part of the step to make sure the providers know it's been thoughtful. It isn't because it's mom and dad, but if the patient wants it there, they should be able to have it. So that's what I've lived through and sort of experienced firsthand in an exam room that did not make it feel like we had a better way to communicate with the provider.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Quick follow-up. So I appreciate that. That was 15 years ago. There's a lot more awareness now of the dangers of it, and I think there's a lot of more reticence from the provider community about giving out opioids, and if they do, they severely limit prescription. I myself have had some orthopedic surgeries, and I don't want the opioids. I don't want them because of the side effects. And there's one in particular that is just awful, and that it has to do with your digestive system. And now I understand why the laxative industry is so huge. And it's no fun. And so I only took it 1 or 2 days just to help, take the edge off. So my question is, my provider was very conscious about that. Aren't the rest of them?
Representative Baker.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think today you're going to find a lot more of this, much better awareness from our providers and everybody down the chain. It has been a remarkable turnaround for the industry. However, there are still some times where you don't know this and you don't have time to talk to the provider. It might be in the back of an ambulance. It might be in an emergency situation. So what we're just trying to do is, if a person really is careful about what is being prescribed to them on any level, whether it's an accident or something down the road or a surgery, upcoming surgery, for your case. They just want to make sure, if I forget to tell somebody, it was in my notes because it's in the directive. So I think it's just an extra step. One page gets loaded in, and that's it. It shouldn't be a burden on anybody, because I am one who does not want to make policies and rules more and thicker and harder. But this is important for people that really understand the power of these drugs. And if they're not done in the right way, it can get them into trouble and right back where they were. It can just take one more. And even just getting a script with that 30 opioids, it'll reel them back to, whoa, maybe I should just keep this for another day. And we just don't want to take that. If they really think this through, they just don't want it. But I think this is a simple tool.
Thank you.
Okay, members, we have about 9 minutes left on this bill, and we have three members with questions. And next is Representative Liebling. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker, I like this idea a lot. I really do. But I have some questions about how it works. And some of that, I think it's, I'm glad it's going to judiciary, because a lot of it really relates to the liability piece. But let me just ask one question that just to clarify what you mean by the language. And that is on line 2.30. It's so this is under the exceptions to compliance. So they need to comply with it except, and then under, so a prescriber health professional acting on the order of a prescriber may administer it anyway, essentially, if, and so on, 2.3, if the patient is being treated in a hospital setting or is being treated in a setting outside a hospital in emergency circumstances. So what I'm not sure about is, are you exempting anybody who's being treated in a hospital, or is the emergency meant to modify that part of it? I hope you understand my question. So do you mean here to exempt a provider if the patient is being treated in a hospital setting in an emergency, or just being treated in a hospital setting, they don't have to follow it? That's the question, if you understand.
Yeah, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Baker.
Mr. Chair, I asked Mr. Renner to come up in case I don't answer this right. But I think, as I understand it, a lot of surgeries are planned and they're thought through and everything else, and some are not. I think for me, it's almost any case, whether it's an emergency, if it's a surgery situation, if the provider did not have access to the information that there was a directive on file, in either case, there's no liability to the provider. Did I answer that question, or maybe I'm not getting it to Mr. Renner? I don't think I answered the question. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner at the Minnesota Medical Association. We didn't draft this language, but my read, and I think the intent, Representative Liebling, is that the emergency circumstances should modify both, because I think it was trying to argue that in those situations where you don't have time to check the medical record, you don't have access to the medical record. That's my understanding, but if others think otherwise, that's why we worked with Representative Baker to put a couple of the other examples or exemptions as well. If you're in the middle of a surgery, this patient doesn't know I don't want them, but you see further complications that in your medical judgment you may need to. So that's the intent, I believe.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
I'm Representative Liebling.
Thank you for that. So I think this section, this line 2.30 and line 2.31 needs to be rewritten, because it's really not clear. It looks like you're trying to exempt anything that happens in a hospital. And I think what you're trying to exempt is something that happens in an emergency, whether in a hospital or not, where you can't access the records. And I think it sort of says that elsewhere, so maybe you don't need that line at all. Anyway, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We are on to Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. As the daughter of a nurse who believes heavily in medical directives, I actually say thank you for this bill. I think it's a good bill. I think it's a good tool in the toolbox. And quite frankly, we would love to think that our providers will listen. But there are circumstances in which, if someone's unconscious, if they're in an ambulance, something like that, if we're able to access those medical records and have access to that information, that's a huge tool for the folks taking care of that patient. And the reality is that you are your own best patient advocate, period, the end, right? And so having the ability to have this tool on file that really spells out clearly what your wishes are with regards to pain management, I think it makes a big difference. And for folks like your son who may be struggling, or even if you're just nervous because you have someone in your family who has struggled, I think this makes a significant improvement in being able to have that available. I will tell you openly, I will plan to sign on to this bill in support of it. I really appreciate this bill. I do hope that we can clarify that language just a little bit on the when you can't access the medical records, because I understand what you're doing, and including the line in the amendment on 1-6 that kind of adds that additional clarification about not having access. But yes, any way we can make it as crystal clear as possible and in plain language is great. But I like the bill, and I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Bierman, our final
thank you, Chair Becker.
Questions.
Thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing this bill forward. I liked it the minute I saw it, and I really appreciate your work on it and bringing it forward. I think it's a commendable piece of legislation that will help a lot of people. I did have one question, and that is, how does it relate, or what would be the process if you do you have to take a separate document to your dentist to make sure that you're covered in that clinic, probably, I would imagine?
I'm Representative Baker.
Boy, that is a very good question, Mr. Chairman. We are going to find out. So this form is going to be uploaded with the Minnesota Department of Health. That's what it's going to be under. But when it reaches over to other providers and other industries, we want to make sure we have more eyes on it. So, Representative Bierman, like Representative Liebling, we have a little bit of tweaking to do here. Let's make sure we get that right. I will tell you again, 10 years ago or maybe 8 years ago when I was here, the friends of ours from the Minnesota Dental Association were the first ones who came to me and said, we need a bill that lessens the way we prescribe, because they knew that they were overprescribing. So I know our dental association friends will be all on board. If there's a way for them to see that as well, that'd be great. So thank you for that, Representative Bierman. I'll make sure that that also gets included so there's clarity at the next stop at the next committee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Follow-up,
Chair Becker.
Representative Bierman.
Yep, we'll get it through Judiciary and get it back here and get it over the finish line. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, members. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Baker, please close on your bill.
Yeah, thank you again, members, Mr. Chair, for the good discussion. That's what the committee process is for, is to make sure we don't miss anything. And we will just tweak a few things. This is important stuff. I miss you all, by the way, because I'm not in Health and Human Services anymore. But I just know the depth of your work here, and I'm grateful for it. Thank you for listening to Mr. Drucker earlier today. We work together a lot on different things. And again, this is an important part of this process of making sure Minnesotans, when they need to come close to an opioid for medical reasons, and there's a very important reason why this is still here in medicine. We just got to make sure the tools are there to help you guys out. So thank you very much, members, and Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. The chair renews his motion that House File 1379, as amended, be referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and House File 1379, as amended, is adopted. I mean, and be headed over to judicial. Thank you. Okay, well, we have one more left. And we, as Representative Lieberman is coming to the table. Okay, next on the agenda is House File 1429 from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I would move that House File 1429 be re-referred to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. And
thank you. And then Representative Liebling, to your bill.
Thank you. And so, members, this is really an agency bill from Director Drucker, and so I'm just going to turn it over to him, and it kind of fits in with the presentation that he gave earlier. Before I do that, let me just say that some of the good questions about coordination of our responses across the state. And in my recollection, kind of the reason that Director Drucker was hired and the reason his office was established is to do that coordination, because you can see from his presentation how much is going on that isn't coordinated. So I'm he hasn't been in his role for very long, so I'm really hopeful that, you know, his presence and his work is going to help pull a lot of that together. So with that, I'm just going to turn it over to him.
Director Drucker, please introduce yourself and keep your testimony to 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Committee members, my name is Jeremy Drucker. I'm the director of the Office of Addiction and Recovery. What we're trying to achieve with this bill is related to some of the data pieces we talked about earlier during the presentation. Right now, our data on opioid overdoses isn't as timely as it could be to catch overdose spikes as they happen. When we do have really solid real-time data, we can spot patterns, like if there's a particularly dangerous drug batch. We talked a little bit about the toxicity of illicit drugs on the street. And public health and safety officials can then act quickly to share information, distribute naloxone, and take other steps that can save lives. So one of the things that we can do that's available to us is that 27 other states already have are sharing data with emergency medical services with a site called ODMAP. ODMAP is run by the Washington and Baltimore High Intensity Drug Trafficking Board. HIDA is what is known as for short. HIDA is a DEA grant-funded program. It's a consortium of state, local, and federal law enforcement officials that really work in areas that have a lot of drug trafficking. They have created a dashboard called ODMAP that allows us to track overdoses by zip code in near real time. So 20 other states are already sharing that data from emergency medical services. What this bill would do is it will allow sharing of de-identified EMS data with ODMAP. That data is limited to things like location, time, what substances were involved, whether naloxone was administered, and whether it was a fatal or non-fatal overdose. Really importantly to add, no information about specific individuals is shared. I know our colleagues from EMS might still be here. We worked with them on this bill. The other thing I would just also add is that only authorized and verified users like first responders, law enforcement, and public health officials have access to ODMAP, so there are safeguards built in place to ensure that individuals can't be identified and only qualified folks have access to it. So with that, this is information that's already being collected by EMS, and so it really just allows that data sharing, and it's a policy-only bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Would anyone from the public like to testify? Okay, seeing none. Members, I will open up to questions and discussion, and the first on board is Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair Backer, and thank you again, Director and Representative Liebing, for bringing this. You know, this has been, Hennepin has been a partner with ODMAP for a number of years, and the last time I looked, I think there was 250 or 300 people that were, or 300 organizations that were already a part of this. And you're right, there is no personal information that's shared. I'm happy to support the bill today. I'm concerned with, on line 1.18, it says the director may share. And, you know, that's part of the problem we have with ODMAP today. And ODMAP is a real-time thing. And so as a law enforcement official or a paramedic or, you know, comes out, it's up to a person that has to literally log on, and they put the incident in there in a timely manner. In some cases, it happens 24 hours later. There's some cities that refuse to do it. I don't think there's any fire departments that do it at all. I think there's some ambulance services that do it. And so right now we can do this. And so I'm wondering, the language says you may share, and I'm just wondering how that is different than what we do in Minnesota right now.
That question is for you there, Representative Drucker, so I'm going to have you do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I might ask Dylan Ferguson to come up and give me an assist here. But I think my understanding is right now is that EMS is prevented from sharing that data, and so this would authorize them to share that data. But I will let Mr. Ferguson dig in on that question a little bit more.
And I think I referred to you as Representative. I'm sorry, there, Director. So we will go to Mr. Ferguson. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Dylan Ferguson, Director of the Office of Emergency Medical Services. Representative Nadeau, to your question, this is specifically to the authorities for the Office of Emergency Medical Services that I serve as the director of. So we receive all of the patient care report data from all of Minnesota's ambulances that come into a kind of a central repository. That data is classified as non-public and private under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. And as a result, we can't necessarily share deaggregated or that incident level latitude and longitude data, which is required for ODMAP. So this gives us the ability to be able to share the data from all of the ambulance services that are reported to us. There are several ambulance services who on their own do make reports to ODMAP today, but essentially what they're having to do is engage in duplicative documentation. They have to document it in their patient care report that comes to us at the state, and then they voluntarily go in and they enter it into ODMAP a second time. What this technical change does is it just gives the Office of EMS the ability and the legal protection to be able to share that with ODMAP, and for partners like Hennepin, EMS, or those other ambulances that are sharing, will actually remove an administrative burden because they will not have to go in and manually enter that anymore, as the state system will automatically take care of it for them every 24 hours.
Follow-up, Representative Dole.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. You know, the whole idea behind ODMAP was a public safety thing. That's what it was. It was basically there to look at national trends. So if there was all of a sudden an uptick in opioid, you know, overdoses in Denver, and then historically the next time there was one in Nebraska, I mean, it was meant for that. And again, I'm happy to support the bill, and I'll stop talking, but I just don't understand the value of this from a, I don't understand the value of using this tool the way I feel like you're trying to use it. It's meant for law enforcement to focus efforts to try to break up drug rings. That's what it's for. It's not really for reporting, you know, opioid deaths, opioid overdoses. That's not, you know, it records them. But that's what it's for. I don't, what do we get out of it? What does EMS get out of it?
Director Ferguson.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Representative Nadeau, to your question, I think the biggest aspect of how it paints a better picture. So EMS has probably the richest data source when it comes to where and when non-fatal overdoses are occurring, because typically EMS is the one who is responding, administering naloxone, and that data is geographically indexed. So that information helps Director Drucker and others that are utilizing that tool to identify those hotspots, including the law enforcement partners. And in terms of what does emergency medical services get out of it, an aspect where, you know, they know what's going on within their community from and what's going on in the borders of their community if they're kind of logged into that. And as we have more and more EMS agencies that are trying different programs such as field-initiated buprenorphine and other EMS-administered opioid use disorder medications, they're playing a more active role in it. So I think it's about painting a more complete picture that all the partners, including law enforcement, to kind of to your point of what ODMAP and HIDA was designed for, it's just providing a more accurate picture of the situation. And I think it also helps by having another metric that would allow MMB and county partners to better ascertain what that true number of non-fatal and fatal overdoses are, Representative Nadeau.
Follow up?
Yep, just and finally, back to my original question on line 1.18. Why is it may and not shall or must?
Director Drucker, I think that's intended for you.
Sure, and I might actually ask Director Ferguson to take that as well. I think we were...
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Director.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Representative Nadeau. I think the primary aspect here is the Office of EMS and the former Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board has wanted to be able to provide this information over the course of years, and we're just looking for the permissive authority under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act to be able to share that. So that was the key aspect, and may versus shall, I don't have any major objections, but just this seems like a no-brainer, and we just had written the language that we're just seeking the permission to be able to do something that seems common sense and a good solid solution. Representative Nudeau and Chair Backer.
Okay, Representative Hemmingson Yeager, you're on deck, or you're on, it's yours.
Thank you, Chair. So you started talking about fentanyl and DEA and started talking about public safety, Representative Nudeau, and that got me thinking back to my crime lab days, and I was a drug chemist. And we started seeing a lot of the poly substances, so fentanyl mixed with weed, fentanyl mixed with tablets, fentanyl mixed with meth, everything. And so I started thinking, is any of this kind of stuff like shared with the BCA, not from like a harming the victims, but like getting to the dealers that are getting these things on the streets? So is any of this getting shared with the BCA?
Who wants to take that one? Director Drucker, it looks like you want to take that.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Thank you, Representative. You know, we work very closely with Superintendent Evans at the BCA, but I would want to check with him before getting back to you on that, exactly what information is shared with BCA right now.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative?
Yeah, just kind of as I'm thinking. So, like, in the lab, we would get them only because there was a criminal charge with it. But if the BCA and the agents were to know kind of more on the trafficking side of things, they could get into there more and get the dealers and kind of interrupt that before it becomes, before people get harmed and before there's people getting charged with, you know, crimes just for using. So, thanks.
Okay, very good. And we have for our last question or questions, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this. I want to say I really appreciate the attention to detail here around disaggregated data. In real time, that's a really important aspect, and I'm grateful that that language is included. I also wanted to say I really love this idea of being able to share in real time. We hear from time to time about outbreaks of new poly substances, for example, and being able to share this data in real time. So let's say if you're at Hennepin Health and you're in the rig, having the ability to know that there's an outbreak in your community in real time and be able to use that as a tool as you're assessing and triaging patients when you pick them up is really, really critical in order to act in a timely fashion. And so, I mean, I'm shocked that we don't have the ability to share this data right now. So I really appreciate this bill. I really think it could actually save lives, and I'm really grateful for it. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Would you like to renew closing statements, and then would you like to renew your motion?
Yeah, just thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and I would renew the motion that it be re-referred to Judiciary.
Okay, Representative Liebling moves that House File 1429 be referred to the Committee of Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and House File 1429 is referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Judiciary. Okay, members.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative.
Oh, yeah, motion gavel. Motion carries. Okay, so seeing no further business before the committee, our next hearing is this Wednesday, March 12th at 1 p.m. We are adjourned, members. Thank you.